We do not have to look very far into the Parsha of Mishpatim in order to find grounds for discussion. The very opening words, Ve'ela ha-Mishpatim asher tosim lifnehem. Moreover, not only the opening words, but the opening letter itself, the Vav, with which the Parsha begins, Ve'ela ha-Mishpatim. Literally, we would translate correctly so, and these are the Mishpatim. And as we know, Rashi quotes it, the Mechilta is his source, that there is an atmospheric and qualitative difference between whether a parsha is introduced with the word Eile or Ve'eile. In the words of Chazal, Eile, if you introduce a parsha with the word Eile, Pasal es harishonos. That comes to move away and push to the side that which came before, to hold up as distinct that which is about to be discussed. Classic example, Eile told us Noach. Noach is distinguished from the generations or the degenerations that had taken place before his time. Eile told us Noach. Ve'eile, on the other hand, Mosif ala Rishonos. The point of the Vav, of course, the Vav is a word. The letter Vav is a word in Lashon HaKodesh. It means a hook. And hooks hold things together. And Ve'eile means to hook together the following parsha with what preceded it. Ve'eile, Mosif ala Rishonim. And the question is, what exactly is the Vav of Ve'eile HaMishpatim coming to add to the section above? Well, what was above? What is the Rishonim in our context? Parshas Mishpatim follows on from Yisro. And Yisro, of course, towards the end, right, is building up to the Aseres Hadibros. And thus, says the Mechilta in the name of Rabbi Yishmael, Ma Rishonim Misinai, Af Eilu Misinai. Ve'eile means the contents of Parshas Mishpatim are similar to the Aseres Hadibros, just like the Aseres Hadibros are from Sinai, so to the contents of Parshas Mishpatim. Those are the words of Rabbi Yishmael in the Mechilta. In fact, the Mechilta is actually hosted, shall we say, by Rabbi Yishmael. He is the one who compiled it. It's known as Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael. Interestingly, Rabbi Akiva has something else to say, as is often the case between him and Rabbi Yishmael. And Rabbi Akiva says his comments are, Archeim lifnehem, with an ayin, Archeim lifnehem, set them up before them, k'shulchan aruch. That's where the term shulchan aruch comes from. Ve'eile ha-mishpatim asher tosim lifnehem, place them before them, k'shulchan aruch, like a set table. That's where Rabbi Yosef Karo got the idea to call his set of laws, which essentially lays everything out in front of you, as the Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah, Rav Moshe Itzelus, who added the glosses of Minag Ashkenaz to the Shulchan Aruch, became known in Halacha as the Bal HaMapa, the owner of the tablecloth, you know, which he spread on top of the Shulchan Aruch. Now, we certainly need to go back to Rabbi Yishmael's words and understand them more closely. For on the face of it, Rabbi Yishmael does not seem to be identifying anything particularly special about Mishpatim, and by that we mean, again, what has he said? Ve'eila Mishpatim, just like Aseres HaDibros is from Sinai, so too Mishpatim is from Sinai. It's singling out Parshas Mishpatim as being unique in that it's also from Sinai. But is that true? Is Mishpatim the only area of Torah in addition to the Aseres Hadibros that's from Sinai? Kol HaTorah Kulo is from Sinai. Moshe Kibel Torah Mi Sinai. Not only Mishpatim, also Truba and Tetzaveh, and everything else. All the 613 mitzvahs. That's important always to distinguish When we say Moshe received the entire Torah from Sinai, it means he received the entire body of Halacha from Sinai. It does not mean he received the entire Chamisha Chumshei Torah from Sinai. That is for sure. That is impossible. Not only is it not true, but it's impossible. Because if Moshe receives the entire Chumash from Sinai, that means the Jewish people have no choice but to make the Chet HaEgel. Moshe must have been tempted to look inside and see that he should not hit the rock in Parshas Chukas, etc., etc. And of course, none of that is possible. The text of the Chamisha Chumshei Torah is something, and this is the Gemara in Gittin, Daf Samach, it's either the Parshas of the Torah, the sections of the Chumash are either given to him immediately after they happen, what's called Megillah, Megillah Nitna, scroll by scroll, or possibly the entire thing is withheld from him in written form until the end, Chasuma Nitna. When we talk about Moshe receiving Torah from Sinai, we're not talking about the text of the Chumash, we're talking about the content of the 613 mitzvahs. Now, our question again, to be clear, Rabbi Shmuel seems to be making a unique situation out of Parshas Mishpatim that is not unique. It's true of all of the mitzvahs. So, Manishtana HaParsha Azos Mikol HaParshios. That is so special. And in order to understand the background, we need to be aware, as the Or HaChaim HaKadosh makes us aware, that this comment of Rabbi Shmuel is set against a major discussion that takes place in three places in the Shas, once again between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel, namely, how to understand exactly how much of the mitzvahs were given at Sinai and how much was given later on. On this point, they argue how to understand. Rabbi Akiva is famous. Why is he famous? Because Rashi quotes him at the beginning of Bahar, Ma Inyan Shmita Etzel Har Sinai, to teach you, just like Shmita, so too all mitzvahs were given, Klolo Sehem, Diktu Kehem, Proto Sehem, Bisinai, all mitzvahs were given not only in a general fashion, but also the particulars at Sinai. That is a quotation from the Toras Kohanim. It represents only one side of the equation, that is the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. His opinion is, Klolim uprotim nemu b'Sinai. The whole thing was said at Sinai. V'nishnu ba'ohel moed was said over again in Ohel Moed. V'nishtalshu ba'arvos Moav and was said a third time the plains of Moab just before going into Eretz Canaan. That's the Mishnah Torah. However, Rabbi Yishmael is of the opinion that only klolim nemu b'Sinai. When we say 630 mitzvahs given at Sinai, indeed, but only the generality of the mitzvah was given at Sinai. Pratim, as a rule, were given in the Ohel Moed in the ensuing time through the communication through the Ohel Moed. And then, Nishnu, that process was repeated altogether in Arvos Moav at the end of their stay in the Midbar. And therefore, again, to take stock, there is a basic debate between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva as to whether, as a rule, even the details of the mitzvahs were given at Sinai. For Rabbi Akiva, yes. For Rabbi Shmuel, no. Only the klalim, says the Or HaChaim HaKadosh. Now we can appreciate the context of Rabbi Shmuel's words. For when Rabbi Shmuel says, Mishpatim is, it's like the Aseres Hadibros. It's very special. It's unique. How is it unique? Marishonim Misinai? Afeilu Misinai. That is indeed unique to Parshas Mishpatim because it's an exception to the rule. The rule for Rabbi Shmuel is that only the generalities of the mitzvahs are given at Sinai. But of course the Aseres Hadibros are given in total, and so too the contents of Parshas Mishpatim are given also Klalim and Protim. That is exceptional. Mishpatim and Aseres Hadibros. Of course, we can appreciate that Rabbi Akiva would say no such thing. Rabbi Akiva could not echo such a sentiment of Rabbi Shmuel for the simple reason that Rabbi Akiva himself is of the opinion that all mitzvahs were given, as we mentioned, both in general and in particular. So that cannot be the yichus of Parshas Mishpatim. What will we say? It was also given at Sinai in its entirety. So is everything else. And indeed, that's why Rabbi Akiva parts ways with Rabbi Yishmael here. And he has a different comment on the beginning of Mishpatim. He doesn't talk about what being from Sinai. He doesn't say that. That's not unique to, or germane, exclusive to Parshas Mishpatim, but he says something else. He makes this comment of Archem Lifnehem Keshulchan Aruch. So a bit of the background, we understand that the different reactions to the Vav of Mishpatim are set against their opinion generally as to how mitzvahs were given. But at this point, we have a serious problem. Namely, in the beginning of Mishpatim, Rabbi Shmuel has his say, and Rabbi Akiva has his say, but they don't seem to be talking about the same thing. They don't seem to be speaking the same language. They don't seem to be addressing the same issue. Rabbi Yishmael is overtly addressing the Vav of Ve'eila HaMishpatim. Why is it linked to beforehand? The answer is, just like before is from Sinai, so too here. That's his response to the Vav. What does Rabbi Akiva have to add to the equation, to the conversation? Rabbi Akiva says, Archem lifnehem kashulchan arach. Make them understand it in an easy way. Make it clear to them. That's a very important thing to do. And it's an important thing to say. But it doesn't seem to be an alternative response to what Rabbi Shmuel is talking about. That seems to be more focusing on the words Asher Tasim Lifnehem. Very nice. Place them before them. But you're not really talking about what Rabbi Shmuel was talking about. This doesn't sound like a machlokas. It's presented as a machlokas, but it doesn't sound like machlokas. And we're all Jewish. And if there's a machlokas advertised and it doesn't happen, we should be upset. Or at least intrigued. And so, the way to proceed here is by referring to a fascinating medrash which describes the flow of events whereby we have Matan Torah, but actually Matan Torah is preceded, of course it's followed by Dinim, which is followed by Mishpatim, as we know, Matan Torah then Mishpatim. But it's actually also preceded by Mishpatim. Because Parshas Yisro, I mean, the subject discussed immediately before the giving of the Torah is once again Dayanim. The whole episode with Yisro, Vata Techezeh, you should set up Sareya Lafim and Sareya Meos. So actually, if we would summarize, the subject matter is Mishpatim, the giving of the Torah, and Mishpatim. And the Medrash Mos Rabbah lays emphasis on that. And says something wonderful but incomprehensible. Namely, Moshe Lematranisa. It says the situation is analogous to a noblewoman, Matranisa, matron, Matranisa. So as she walks, so a noblewoman is always has a guard who walks before her and after her. So too, says Shmos Rabbah, the Torah is like that. The Torah is the Matranisa. And it has a guard that walks before it and after it. It is preceded by Mishpat and it is followed by Mishpat. And the question is, what exactly has one got to do with the other? How does that become a poignant and meaningful analogy to the flow of events of Mishpat, Torah, Mishpat, to the guard of honor for the Matranisa? And the Be'er Yosef has a most thought-provoking analysis of the entire institution that we call Mishpatim. Every nation has Mishpatim, of sorts. What is the goal of Mishpat? If we move from law to legal philosophy, to the meta questions, why should there be Mishpat? I mean, what are we looking to accomplish by having a system of Mishpat? So that question is certainly not hard to answer or to provide an answer for. The intuitive answer is a society will break down. The good upright citizens need to be protected. There has to be some form of law and order. Law breeds order. It's correct. But when it comes to the Mishpatim of the Torah, as true as that is, as a first response, there is clearly much more to it than that. there is clearly much more to the goal of Mishpatim than merely for me to protect my property. And let us see by example. Let us begin with the first of the Mishpatim. And it is not for nothing that it's the first of the Mishpatim. Eved Ivri. Now, Eved Ivri chronologically should not be first, because by definition, if he's sold as a slave, he's already stolen, which is another one of the Mishpatim, which means we're starting in the middle. But of course, it's chosen first. As we know, Eved Ivri is a lesson in how to take care of someone more than anything else. He will never work for more than 6 years, because of Shabbos. Regardless, his conditions have to be at least equatable with that of the master. He can't live in substandard conditions. He has to be taken care of. And moreover, he cannot be given just any job. And he has to work for you. But the halacha is you cannot give him a job which is gnai. To muck out the stables. It's pasnished. It's pasnished for an Eved Ivri. So who's going to do it? Let the master do it. No one's stopping him from doing it. You have to be considerate of the Eved Ivri. Lesudenu beferech. You're not allowed to work him in a way that will break him. Not only physically, even emotionally. There's an amazing halacha. The halacha states, you are not allowed to say to the Eved Ivri, I would like you to work on this job until I come home. And not tell him when you're coming home. Because it's painful for a person to have an obligation and they don't know when it will end. Now you can tell him, I'll be home at 4. And you're entitled to say, he is meant to work for you. And now it's 8 in the morning, I'll be back in 4 and I would like you to work on this job. But if you say, until I come home, and I don't know when I'll be home, but until then, that's parech. Ad kedei kach. And as we know, by the time you're finished with your Eved Ivri, we well understand why the Gemara says, kola kone Eved, kone Odon la'atzmo. If you purchase a Hebrew servant, you have purchased a master for yourself. The way you have to take care of him, and this is pre-trade union, this is Ben Odom Lachaveiro, this is Parshas Mishpatim. And that's the first one. That's the opener. And as we go forward in Mishpatim, we see more of the same. The mitzvah of lending money. The mitzvah to lend money. The way the borrower is protected, in the end, you'll get your money. Says the Torah, quoting from Mishpatim, Lo siye lo kenoshe. You can't hound him. You cannot wait outside his house and picket him until he pays you the money back. Even as you take collateral, but you're not allowed to enter his house to take collateral. You are entitled to demand that he bring you something. But you cannot invade his privacy. And he owes you money. But it's his house. Says the Gemara, so if you wait for him to bring out collateral to you, what do you think he's going to bring out? His most valuable objects? You don't know what he has inside his house. He can choose. Borrower of choice. And moreover, whatever you do take as collateral, says the Pasuk, if he needs it, you have to give it back to him. So essentially, when you take collateral, which for most people is where they really, their sense of propriety gets going, you're practically running a gemach for him anyway. And what do we make of all of this? It's clear, says the Ber Yosef, if you take a good look at Parshas Mishpatim, you'll see it's not about the victim's rights only. That's not the goal. The goal is not to make sure that if anyone violates one of my rights, I am reimbursed as swiftly and as surely as possible. It's not about that. It is about the best use of my property within the law. How is it possible to help another fellow Jew without placing myself in jeopardy or out-and-out loss? But how can I use my assets in a way that will be of most benefit? In the case of Eved Ivri, to rehabilitate him, not just to punish him, not just to squeeze the money from him, but maybe to show him a bit of yachas that nobody else ever showed him. In the case of Alva, I'll get my money in the end, but to treat him like a mensch. And that really, all of this is encapsulated in the Medrash. The Medrash says the Torah is the Matar Nisan. The Torah is a noble way of life. And of course, no one, or no time did we ever appreciate so much that nobility when as we stood at Har Sinai. And that's a fascinating point to ponder. For if you catch a person at any given time in their life or in their week and say, what are your hopes for your money? It's a natural human response to answer near the lowest common denominator. I'd like to be comfortable, and I'd like to all the things that people would like. But at Har Sinai, of course, it's clear to us that everybody's perspective on their possessions and what do they want from their possessions and what do they hope to do with them and what are their aspirations, all of that changed. It was elevated to a higher level entirely. And that is the Matar Nisan. But the question is, how do you preserve that? Because easy to feel at Har Sinai and easy to let go. Unless the Matar Nisan is guarded. A guard before, a guard after. In what way are the Mishpatim the guards of the nobility of Matan Torah? Because they are a legal encryption of those values. When Mishpatim demands of you to behave with the altruism and with the nobility that you felt at Har Sinai, because otherwise Parshat Mishpatim is a closed book for you. It's meant to help me, and noch I end up helping him. At Har Sinai you would never ask that question. And in a sense, says the Be'er Yosef, now we understand that when Rabbi Akiva had his response to Ve'ela HaMishpatim, and he said, Archeim lifnehem k'shulchan aruch. Spread them out in a way that they will be understandable. That was also responding to the Vav at the beginning of Mishpatim, just as Rabbi Yishmael was. Rabbi Yishmael had his say, that it's about Ma'elu Misinai. Rabbi Akiva doesn't go that route, but he's relating to the same issue. Why are Mishpatim connected to Sinai? The answer, says Rabbi Akiva, is they have to be connected to Sinai, otherwise they won't make any sense. Archeim lifnehem k'shulchan aruch. Remember Sinai, and Parshas Mishpatim will make sense to you. If you lose the aspirations of Sinai, Mishpatim will not be a shulchan aruch, it will be a book of riddles for you. And what's fascinating is, in Parshas Devarim, well-known psukim for us, Sefer Devarim, Parshas Vayeschanan, which says, Ki mi goy gadol, this is in Devarim, Perek Dalet, Ki mi goy gadol asher lo chukim u'mishpatim tzadikim, kechol ha-Torah hazos. What other nation has chukim u'mishpatim tzadikim? Literally, that means that their mishpatim are tzadikim, their mishpatim are righteous. Because the goal of mishpat is to be righteous with your money. And the very next pasuk at Vayeschanan says, the well-known pasuk, Raki shamer lecha, u'shmor nafshecha ma'od, pentishkach es hadvarim asheru einecha, u'fein yasur milvavcha, etc., etc., yom asher amadot alafnei Hashem elokecha b'chorev. That is the very next pasuk. Take care. Never forget the day that you stood before Hashem in Chorev. Why is that the next pasuk to Mishpatim Tzadikim? Because if you forget what it was like at Chorev, so you will completely miss the point of what Mishpatim is all about. And indeed, in Parshas Beshalach, when we got our first taste of Mishpatim, in Mara, which was one of our first stations after Kriyas Yamsov, it says, Sham Samlo Chok U'Mishpat, says the Be'er Yosef, before our orientation at Har Sinai, the laws of the Torah were more chok than they were mishpat. But by the time you've been through Har Sinai, they become mishpatim, as long as you remember Har Sinai, which is a fascinating way of understanding not only mishpatim, but also the mitzvah to remember Har Sinai. The mitzvah to remember Har Sinai, which we all know, I mean, it's a machlokas, Rambam and Ramban, whether it's one of the Tariag mitzvahs. For the Ramban, it's on the list that the Rambam forgot to include, Mitzvah Saseh Dalet, I believe. But in any event, Why is it so important to remember Sinai? Normally, I think we would say as the basis of Emunah, which is a good and worthy answer. But according to this, part of the mitzvah of remembering Har Sinai is in order that you present yourself in a place where the mitzvahs around you have meaning and are readily understandable as the best way to conduct yourself with your possessions. So these are most, to my mind, most insightful and, as I said, thought-provoking sentiments with regards to the beginning of Mishpatim and indeed the entirety of Parshas Mishpatim. Now there is a pasuk which in recent weeks I saw something which really was riveting for me. And it relates to Perek Yud Dalet of Pasuk Kaf Aleph. And the background to this comment on that pasuk is actually about 50 or so years ago. For, as we know, I believe it was in the early 60s, I don't know the date, I'm sure some of you will know it more accurately, Adolf Eichmann, Yimach Shemo, had been hiding out in South America and Argentina for many years. And he was finally tracked down by the Israeli Secret Service and kidnapped, actually. And if you know the story, and everyone knows the story, how they basically, they drugged him and then they took him out. Now, as is often the case, the spectacular extraction was followed by dissatisfaction with certain parties. And one of the offended parties was the president of Argentina, who felt that his sovereignty had been violated. He did not offer any words of explanation as to how he felt about having harbored someone like that for all those years. That was somehow not part of the discussion. The wrongdoing in question is the fact that Israel had clandestinely removed someone from his soil without notifying him. And of course, Israel by that stage was not interested in asking questions. And he demanded that he be returned because he'd been extradited illegally. If you think Jews have a monopoly on chutzpah, so now we know. So the Israeli Prime Minister's office was at a loss at how to respond, which they often are. And they got in contact with the Klausenberger Rebbe. The Klausenberger Rebbe, Rav Yehuda Yekusiel Halberstam, who, if you know anything about him, was a person of indomitable strength. His ability to survive, he lost everything. He himself went through the camps, and he was shot twice. And to rebuild what he built, essentially single-handedly, borders on the incomprehensible, the whole of Kiryat Sanz in Netanya and the Laniado Hospital and the whole thing. And they turned to the Klausenberger Rebbe to respond, to offer some form of response. And he writes a letter, and there's a few things, but one thing particularly, he begins by describing what he himself went through, and he was Hungarian. And Eichmann, of course, was in overseeing all of that. But there is one point specifically, and if I just read three or four lines, this is from his letter to the president of Argentina then. Batoras Moshe, shenitnan lanu ayde borei ha'olam. So in the Torah of Moshe, given to us by the creation of the Creator of the world, v'shekulanu ma'aminim b'kedushasa, even the president of Argentina, must have been a good Christian at least, Old Testament, ne'emar, it says, and he quotes from Parshas Mishpatim, Perakath Aleph, Pasuk Yud Dalet, v'chi yazid ish al re'ehu lehagova arma. If a person acts yazid, mazid, wantonly, deliberately, against his friend, to kill him with guile, arma, arum. Me'im mizbechi tekechenu lamus, take him from the mizbeach, to kill him. Now what does that mean, take him from the mizbeach? What it means is, that as we know, and Rashi says, even if he's a Kohen, and he claims asylum, or claims sanctuary, literally, by the Mizbeach, doesn't matter. You take him, he could be in the middle of Avodah, it doesn't make a difference. Says Rav Halberstam, Ein ba'olam makom mekudash yoter mibeis hamikdash le'elokim. There is no holier place in the world than God's holy temple. On that we can agree. Va'al af kudusha zu, in spite of its holiness, ne'emar shemutar lakachat gam es hakohen hagodol ve'es avodoso. Even if he's a kohen gadol, it doesn't make a difference. If he murdered deliberately, the Torah has no hesitation to take him from there. Says the Klausenberger Rebbe, Kozos Beratzeach Yochid. All of this is true for someone who killed one person. Vekan, in our instance, Beratzeach Hamonim, we're talking about a mass murderer, Ratzeach Mishpachosenu, Harenu Viladenu, our families, parents and children, Zekenim Utsirim. Im kol hakavod ligvulot medinatcha uleribanuta. With all due respect to the sanctity of your national borders and to its sovereignty, hare lo takpid yoter mehashem mikdash elokim. I request of you that you not be more insistent about protecting the sanctity of your borders than God Himself is about His holy place in the Beis Hamikdash, because with all due respect, your country is not God's holy temple. And therefore, if God said, for a single murder, I don't care where he is, even if he's in my holiest place, you take it from there straight away. So, says the Klausenberger, forgive us if we do not hold your country to a level of sanctity higher than that. And with that, the matter rested. So this was truly, of course, and there's so much behind what he was saying, but that's a comment that I could not let go unsaid with this first run of Mishpatim, having seen that a few weeks ago. Now, I'd like to move from from the beginning of the Parsha to the heart of Mishpatim. And of course, Mishpatim, it's all about Ben Odom Lachaveiro, and there's many halachos, and Bava Kama is there with damages, and Bava Metzia is there with contracts and guardianship. And I would like to focus on what's known as the Arba'a Shomrim, the four guardians. Anyone who knows, who's heard the term Shomer, so as we know, a Shomer is someone probably best described as someone who legally has in his possession something that belongs to somebody else. That anyone who has that is some form of shomer. He's either looking after it for the other person, or he's borrowing it from him, or he rented it from him, or all of those really fit the above description. He is someone in legal possession of an item that belongs to somebody else. And of course, within the context of our Chumash here, I would like to see how these shomerim are referred to in the Chumash, because there may be one or two things that we take for granted that we should not do so. And this is to be found in Perek Kaf Beis, Shmos Perek Kaf Beis, Pasuk Vav. So the Torah's treatment of Shomrim, which occupies the bulk of the third and eighth Perek of Maseches Bava Metzia, the Torah's treatment is to be found from Pasuk Vav until Pasuk Yud Dalet. So those seven or eight psukim, they are the entirety of the Shomrim. Now, what's interesting is we should note firstly that there are actually only three sections that deal with Shomrim. Three groups of psukim. They are from Pasuk Vav Teches, is Shomer number one. The second Shomer is Pasuk Tes to Yud Beis. And then the third Shomer is Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet. Now, what's most noteworthy is, and if we know, if we would just go through them by name, we have in ascending level of responsibility, you start with your Shomer Chinam, he's looking after it for you for a favor. And then Shomer Socher, he's looking after you for you for money. That's number two. At the top, you have a Shoel, someone who borrows. And those are the three that are mentioned in the Torah. Sachir is mentioned only obliquely. Sachir is a renter. And in fact, there is even a question as to how stringently or leniently the Sachir, the renter, should be treated. Because he is using it, but he's paying for its use. So that's actually a bit of a shaila. But the first pertinent point is that of these three subsections, only one of them has a name attached to it. And by that I mean, if we look in Pasuk Yud Gimel, which is the third of the subsections, it is the only one of those three that tells us under what conditions he came into possession of the item. Namely, he borrowed it. V'chi yish'al. Yish'al means he borrowed. Interestingly, the first two sections, namely once again, from Vav to Ches, and from Tes to Yud Beis, do not introduce the terms of the agreement. We don't know, and clearly he's looking after it, but is he looking after it for free, or for pay, what we would call Shomer Chinam, Shomer Socher. So we know that those are the two types of Shomrim, but the question is, how can we fathom which parsha of the Torah accrues to which? That's the question. They're not labeled. The Torah doesn't say, if a person gives something to his friend to look after, for nothing. And then if a person gives something to his friend to look after, for money. It doesn't introduce them that way, in the way that it introduced the Shoel. So we have to work it out. Now clearly, of course, they will be, the first two sections will be dealing with these two types of Shomer. But how can you tell which is which? So interestingly, there are two answers to this question. The first is if you look at the verdict, look at the level of responsibility that's demanded within each section, and let us state as an intuitive truth that if I'm being paid to look after an object, so the level of my responsibility is higher. So let me survey both of these sections and see which ones level of responsibility is higher, and I will know that refers to the Shomer Socher, the one who's being paid, and the one with which the Torah is more lenient, presumably, is the Shomer Chinam, because he's doing you a favor. And that's actually how the Gemara addresses the issue. And how does it come out? Because the first set of psukim exempts the person if it's stolen from him. He cannot be negligent. But if he was pickpocketed, right, he was stolen from him, he's exempt. And that is in Pasuk Vav, right, which is the first of these three groups. Ki yitein ish al re'ehu, kesef ha'kelim lishmor. So if a person gives his fellow things to look after, v'gunav mi beis ha'ish, and it was stolen, so im yimatzei ha'ganav, yishalem shnayim. If they find the thief, of course, as we know, the ganav always pays twice, but the thief isn't always found. So let's say the thief is not found. So where do things lie between the guardian who says that it was stolen from him? Pasuk Zayin, im lo yimatzeh ganav, v'nikrav balabayis elo Elohim, which is a reference to taking a shvuah. It's one of the oaths that the Torah demands to clear his name. Im lo shalach yado b'melech esrei ehu, just that he did not do anything improper. He did not act improperly or try and even take some for himself. As long as he acted responsibly, he can excise himself from the situation with a shavua. And therefore, according to what is the situation with the first group of psukim? If it was stolen from you, take a shavua and you're in the clear. What about the second, which begins in Pasuk Tes? Ki yitein ish el re'ehu, once again, if a person gives things. So, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vim ganov yiganev me'imo, if it's stolen from him, yishalem lebalav. So you have to pay. We're very sorry. But you have to pay, it was stolen from you. So clearly, it comes out over the issue of being stolen from him that the second parsha is more strict than the first one. And therefore, says the Gemara, it stands to reason that the second parsha that deals with the Shomer Socher, because he's being paid, he's held to a higher standard, and the first parsha that deals with the Shomer Chinam. ironically, for the sake of completion, there is one respect that the first parsha could end up being more stringent than the second. But it is a phantom chumrah. And by that I mean that if in the first situation he's a shomechinam, so then when the time comes and he said it was stolen from him, and he takes a shavua to that effect, and then it turns out that it wasn't really stolen from him. He had it all, the whole time. So the halacha is he pays double because he's a thief.
He didn't know he had it.
He knew he did.
He did.
He did. He pays double. So in a sense, of course, we would only in the most superficial of terms, we would say, so that's a chumrah that exists, a stringency that exists within the first section that doesn't exist in the second. Why? Because in the second, he could never make it past the point that he said it was stolen from me. As soon as he says he'd stolen, he has to pay up. So he could never take it, he could never abuse the law and then be penalized by it. So as much as there does exist this stringency within the first section relative, it's only a stringency that's born of a leniency, which means essentially it doesn't represent anything more stringent. So that is the first approach. Consider the halachas, which is more chamor, and your natural topography will give you the shomer sachar accruing to the more stringent. What's fascinating is that the Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, grandson of Rashi, both in his Perush on the Torah and in the Tosfos, because let us not forget, if he's a grandson of Rashi, he's going to be writing Tosfos also. Rashbam features very prominently amongst the Balei HaTosfos, and he talks about it in his commentary on Bava Metzia. He has an entirely different way of deducing which of these two sections deals with whom. Says the Rashbam, don't only look at the halachas, who's treated more stringently, but have a look at the type of items that the Torah is discussing as being handed over for safekeeping. And then ask yourself, which of these would you demand payment for, and which of these would you not? For if we look back again, in Pasuk Vav, which is the first of the sections, Ki yiten ish el re'eu kesef o kelim lishmor. So what is being given over for safekeeping? Money. Things. Says Rashbam, things do not need to be taken care of. They need to be put away. But they're low maintenance. And therefore, they represent the type of item that one would typically do a favor. Would you mind looking after this kli? What does it demand of me? Nothing. Just find a safe place in your house for it, that's all. You don't have to feed it. You don't have to do anything. Clean up after it. It's a vase. It's money. The second, see the entities in question shifted. Because in Pasuk Tes, which is the second section, all of a sudden we're no longer talking about vessels and money. We're talking about things that move, walk, make a mess, and need upkeep. Ki yiten ish el re'ehu chamor oshor oseh, says Rashbam. It's not for nothing that the Torah shifted the type of item that we're talking about. The default understanding is that if it demands nothing of me, I'm not going to demand anything of you to look after it. But if it's something that I'm going to need to take care of and of expense, so then I'm involved in upkeep. I would ask for sachar for that. So it's very interesting, and of course, at this point, our discussion about this ends, but what would be the interplay of these two ways of deducing which parsha is which? The Gemara seems to do it by doing a halacha scan and seeing which is more stringent. The Rashbam took a completely different angle and did an inventory approach and just see what does the Torah describe and what would we intuit the person would naturally ask for sachar, as opposed to not. But it's most interesting to note that, and I mention it as much for this reason, we take for granted that the first parsha is Shomer Chinam and the second is Shomer Sachar. But there is no advertising as such. It isn't until the third one that it explicitly says V'chi Yishal. Now, I would like to, just while we are on the subject of Shomrim, and I'm not sure when we will get back, just to foray briefly into a fascinating discussion with regard to Shomrim. A dilemma that could occur, which is discussed in the Mishnah in Bar Mitzvah. Namely, well, the words are to have them. It's in Daf Lamed Ches Amud Aleph. A person deposits fruit. Fruit could be any type of produce by his fellow. And then absconds until further notice. He's out of communication. Hamafkid peiros etzel chaveiro. Okay, so I'm the guardian, and I have my friend's fruit is by me. Fruit, with time, will begin to deteriorate. Afilu hein avudin, even if it's deteriorating. Lo yigabahem, don't touch it. Now, of course, for us, this entire scenario is very difficult to envisage because we can no longer imagine a situation that you could not be in touch instantly through some form of device with the owner. Between the phone and the text and the email and the fax and then whatever else is coming next. So within a matter of moments, you could be in touch with him and say, buy, sell or don't sell? That is the question. But of course, in the times of the Gemara, and up until relatively recently, you could have a situation where you could not consult him. It's up to you. And the first opinion in the Mishnah says, don't touch it. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel omer, mochron bifnei bezdin, sell it. Because it's deteriorating. Sell it. Mipneishu kameishiv aveda labailim. Because otherwise it will be lost. In the course of time it will be lost. Now, we should stress straight away that as much as it's a machlokas in the Mishnah, but it's only a machlokas on a very mild level. In other words, if it's deteriorating in a way that fruit tends to deteriorate, the normal rate, so then that's normal, and the first opinion says he'd prefer to have his own produce. He doesn't want to convert it. That's we intuit. We on his behalf, we imagine. The famous statement of the Gemara, Rotza Odin Bekav Shelo, Mitisha Kabin Shel Chaveiro. A person likes to have his own. He likes to have his own produce that he grew with his own two hands. Or at the very least that he bought with his own two hands. But Reb Shimon Gamliel says, no, you should sell. As soon as she signs a deterioration, sell. But the point is, that disagreement exists on a very specific point in the scale. Because if it's deteriorating chronically, which could happen, it's very hot, it's very damp, or it's very deteriorating chronically, no one argues anymore. Sell. Because if you don't sell, all is lost. What will you present him with in the fullness of time? A heap of compost? So for sure. So as much as it's a machlokas, but it's a machlokas at a certain point. But let's take for argument's sake, it's deteriorating rapidly. Sell. No question about it. Now, if there's no question about it, then what is our question? Our question is, let's say he gave you fruit, and it's deteriorating rapidly. So you have to sell. What if you don't sell? Of course you should. But if you didn't, and the whole thing just rots. So the question is, are you liable to reimburse him for that money? For that produce? Now, of course, on the face of it, there should be no question. You're a shomer. And your job is you can't be negligent, and you were negligent. So of course you should pay. You should have sold. You didn't sell. So you should pay. Where does the question begin? The question begins in the most delicate place. For when Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel in the Mishnah presented the case for selling, he said, sell. Mipneishu kemeshiv aveda. Because it's like Hashavas Aveda. Now the very interesting question is, what does he mean by that? What does he mean by bringing in the concept of Hashavas Aveda? I've got my hands full with the idea of being a shomer. Hashavas Aveda has got nothing to do with being a shomer. Hashavas Aveda is true even if it wasn't entrusted. There exists a general mitzvah that if I see any of my friend's assets which are headed towards loss, like I see a stream that's gushing towards his property and I could divert it or whatever, I have a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. It's preemptive Hashavas Aveda. Not only if he lost it, do I have to give it back? I have to prevent it from becoming lost. Now the question is, and if we watch carefully, what exactly does Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel mean by invoking Hashavas Aveda? And let's hear two sides, two possibilities. It could be that what he means to say by Hashavas Aveda, by mentioning Hashavas Aveda, he's just looking to counter the first opinion. The first opinion says, don't sell, because he doesn't want you to sell. He wants you to hold on to it. And Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, he does want you to sell Hashavas Aveda. So in other words, he's only invoking Meshiv Aveda, you're looking out for his interests, to counter the notion that he doesn't want you to sell. He does want you to sell. As soon as he wants you to sell, so you default back to your obligations, look after his property, and if you're negligent, you should have to pay. That's one possibility. So he is mentioning Hashavas Aveda merely as a counterpoint in the argument, which will then center things back again to your responsibilities as a shomer. Or could it be? Could it be that when Reb Shimon Gamliel says, sell because of Hashavas Aveda, he is actually saying, for some reason, listen, maybe as a shomer, you do not have to sell. But don't forget, you are no different than any Jew who passes by, who sees a loss accruing to him, and you have a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. So perhaps actually when he mentions Hashavas Aveda, he's saying there's a new mitzvah here. Your vision is bifocal. There are certain respects that you're obligated as a shomer, and even if you're not obligated as a shomer, you're no different than any other Jew who sees his friend's possessions in peril. Hashavas Aveda. And should we ask the question, and we must ask the question, L'mai nafke mina? What difference does it make if your obligation draws from the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda or from your profile as a shomer? The nafke mina is black and white. If it's in violation of your status as a shomer, you have to pay. But if your obligation stemmed from a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, as surely as you have to, you're obligated to perform the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. But if I'm a passerby and I see my friend's assets are in peril, and I neglect to perform the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, I don't have to pay for the damage. So it's a qualitatively different type of obligation. But of course the question would be, why on earth would I not have to sell as a shomer and merely have this broader Jewish concern which is called Hashavas Aveda? So what's interesting is the answer to this question came out by a halacha which is a little bit closer to home, shall we say. A fascinating halacha in Hilchos Pesach. For the question comes up, what happens if one Jew deposits chometz with another Jew and then leaves town? So here I am, I'm in a bit of an uncomfortable situation because Pesach approaches and I have chometz belonging to somebody else. Now it's still his, of course, it belongs to him, which means it is in my hands as to whether or not he will violate the Torah prohibition of owning chometz. Now, of course, what's the best solution? What's the best defense? Sell! Sell now! Sell low, sell high. Doesn't matter. Just sell while you can. And that happens to be true. That's the halacha. Because there is no greater situation of potential chronic loss, chronic deterioration, than him doing an isser and the entire thing being forbidden for him to use after Pesach. So that's called chronic loss. Sell. Everyone would say to sell. But of course, there's always going to be someone who doesn't sell. And now the question is, which the Magen Avraham raises, is what happens if you don't sell? Now, past a certain point in Erev Pesach, you can no longer sell. It's past that point of Chatzos, or an hour before Chatzos, you don't have the technology to sell anymore. And actually, what you'd need to do at that stage, you have no choice. You're going to have to destroy it. You'll have to burn the chometz in order to stop him. And again, we're assuming that he hasn't sold it. We don't know what to assume because he hasn't been in contact. So you should sell. And if you pass the sell by date, which is the fifth hour of Erev Pesach, you have to burn it. Says the Magen Avraham, you do have to burn it, and then you have to pay for it. Because you should have sold it. So you are negligent in that you didn't sell. You held off for selling. What were you waiting for? Premium price? You should have sold, and you didn't sell. You were negligent. So you were forced to destroy it with your own hands. But you're a shomer for him. You should pay. says the Baal HaTanya, the Alter Rebbe, the Reb Shneur Zalman, in his Shulchan Aruch HaRav, you don't have to pay. And the reason why you don't have to pay, and if all of this really now traces back to our Hashava Saveda issue, the reason why is fascinating. What is the job of a shomer? That is the question. A guardian, what is his job? His job is as follows. To protect the item from any harm and restore it safe and sound to the original owner. That's his job. Now sometimes, that will be impossible. For example, the original item is fruit. It's rotting away. You have no control over that. You cannot stem that or reverse it. So, pending the owner coming back, now, in the course of time, it is beyond your control. You will be unable to return to him the original item. It cannot be done. But now comes another question. Financially, fiscally, could you put him in a good position? Because if his fruit is deteriorating, maybe sell. Now, of course, if you sell the fruit, he'll never get it back. You sold it to somebody else. So we're no longer looking at you. We're outside of the circle of Shomer. You can never give it back to him. But at least can you look out for his financial interests? The answer is yes, and you should. But it's got nothing to do with you being a Shomer anymore. That's called Hashava Saveda. That's called that. When you become his financial manager, that's called Hashava Saveda. That's not called a Shomer. And the very same thing is true, says the Alter Rebbe, with regards to Chametz on Pesach. You can't give it back to him, because if you keep it, he will have violated an Isser and he can't use it. So that's a wash. It's impossible. The only thing you can do is at the very least redeem some of its value for him. You should do that, but that's Hashava Saveda. But neglect of Hashava Saveda doesn't mean that you need to reimburse him for the loss that he suffered. It means you didn't do a mitzvah. And that it is on that basis that he understands that when Rabbi Shimon Gamliel mentioned the words Hashava Saveda in the Mishnah, he really meant the mitzvah of Hashava Saveda and not Shomer. So that's a fascinating question. And by the way, what that means is when the food begins to deteriorate, so not only does it, if we appreciate the discussion, not only does our Shomer have a bit of a dilemma, should I sell or did I not sell, he has more than a dilemma. He has a conflict of interests. Because he has two obligations that are actually opposing each other. He has an obligation of Hashava Saveda, which means sell, to save him some money. But countering that, he has an obligation as a Shomer, which says hold on to it so you can give it back to him. That is the full glory of the problem. What's interesting is, and I've not followed this through, but I wonder whether this psak of the Alter Rebbe would be maybe a little bit different nowadays. And the reason why is because based on the above analysis, once you sell, you'll never get it back. And presumably, that's the way chometz used to be sold. When you sold your chometz, you would never see it again. The way we sell chometz is quite different. You fully expect, of course you could never demand, in which case your sale is null and void, but you fully expect and certainly rely on the fact that when you sell it to him, he'll give it back to you. So could it be that actually what used to be merely Hashava Saveda, because you can never give him the item back, may once again fall within the reach of your obligation as a Shomer, because if you can sell it, then it could be sold back to you, and then you can give it back to him after Pesach, which is a job as a Shomer. So does your job as a Shomer require you to have a break in the circuit, to put it into timeout, so to speak, in order to be able to reclaim it and yet return it as a Shomer? That is food for thought. But of course, what we see from the Poskim, more than anything else, the attention to detail of all of these cases is because Mamonam Shel Yisrael is part of Torah. And I think that's another aspect of Ma Rishonim Misinai Af Elu Misinai. Just like the Aseres Hadibros, no one doubts and no one has anything missing from their religious fervor. Anuch Hashem Elokecha, Kabedus Avicha Vesimecha, Zoch Hashem Shabbos Lekacho. So to the second set of Dibros, with all of the Pratim, Ma Rishonim Misinai Af Elu Misinai. Being careful in the halacha, in terms of being a good shomer, in terms of Hashava Saveda, and all the details. And when you talk about money, it can be very detailed. That is as holy a discussion as the Aseres Hadibros themselves. And that's also part of the message from the Vav that links the two. We'll leave it over there.